June 3rd, 1942, Japanese bombed Dutch Harbor in Alaska's Aleutian Islands. 4 days later, 2,500 Japanese soldiers occupied the islands of Attu and Kiska. Japanese wanted to control the North Pacific air and sea routes. They thought they could stave off U.S. attacks by controlling them. The U.S. thought the islands might give the Japanese a base to attack the West Coast. The U.S. counterattacked a year later, and in the ensuing battles, more than 1,000 U.S. soldiers died in combat and from the cold and infections, and at least 2,000 Japanese soldiers were killed. It's a little unclear. Ryan Payton has written a novel about that time, The Wind Is Not a River. He is a journalist. He's written for the Chicago Tribune, Boston Globe, the LA Times. Thank you for being here.
Thanks for having me.
And you live in Vancouver.
That's right. Yeah.
What attracted you to this American story?
Well, I'm an American, born in the States, and Canadian dual citizen. And I was living in Anchorage, Alaska at the time when I came across this information. I was a young teenager. I was 13 years old when we moved up to Anchorage. And being the precocious kid I was, I thought I knew a few things about World War II. But in fact, I did not know about the story of the war in Alaska. And then, you know, I got a little bit upset that why don't people in the lower 48 states not know about this war? And so at the time, I thought it bears looking into. And then by my late teens, I had read what was available in the nonfiction historical accounts of the war. And I thought, well, this would make a great backdrop for a novel. I always knew I wanted to be a writer. And filed that away. And then finally, in 2001, 2002, I started to dig in on the story.
What most intrigued you about it being a backdrop for a novel? The landscape? The people?
It's the unknown story. This battle, in proportion to the number of men engaged, it is surpassed only by Iwo Jima as the most costly American battle of the Pacific theater. Now, it's a tough battle. We're not talking about tons of people. We're talking about, as you say, just over 1,000. But the proportion of men, it was a terrible loss. And so I thought, I wondered, why don't people know about this? And that question led to other questions, which led to the realization that the U.S. government rounded up the journalists and booted them out of the Alaskan theater at the time. And so if you look at the other battles that were fought in Europe, fought throughout the South Pacific, fought throughout Asia, there was the benefit most often than not of civilian press available with those men. And the stories came home. The men who fought in Alaska didn't get that benefit because they rounded up the journalists and kicked them out. Now, in reality, several of those journalists who were booted tried to sneak back in to bring the story home because you had congressmen banging on the desk saying, why don't we have more news of the battle happening in our own territory? So these journalists thought, well, they're right. We better do something about it. They got caught again and were told, look, if you want to do this again, you can spend the rest of the jail or longer, or sorry, rest of the war in jail or longer. And they were sent home and went on to other stories. So I knew right then when I read that piece of information.
You know what? Your main character spends a lot of time in Alaska. You know, authors don't like to give away lots of their stories, but so spends a lot of time in Alaska. And his relationship that he has with the U.S. forces there, are those historically accurate? It sounds like they were. There's a lot of tension.
There is. And, you know, I read a lot of nonfiction, and I know that many people, their only experience with this story may be through this novel. So it was important to me not just to get the broad brush details right, to get the small details right as well.
What about the native peoples? How were they treated historically? And then let's talk about how you treat them in the story.
Well, you know, it's a sad story of what happened there. You know, the Japanese, when they took Attu and Kiska, the two outermost islands, there was a small native population on Attu. We're talking about the Aleut people here. And they were rounded up, made prisoners. And
how many? About 800?
No. That's the total number of Aleut people in the chain. But there were about 44 people on the island of Attu at the time who were rounded up and taken to Japan, held as prisoners of war on Hokkaido. The rest of the Aleut people, over 880 people scattered throughout the Aleutian chain, were rounded up by the U.S. military and evacuated for their own protection, and it was a good idea to evacuate them. What happened next is a terrible disgrace for the nation, and that is they were interned in Southeast Alaska, much like we imagined how the Japanese were interned during World War II. There were no fences keeping them in, but they were dumped off in disused canneries, old salmon canneries on the south coast of Alaska, in an environment completely foreign to them. They've lived their entire lives, you know, in this windswept area with no trees. They were left without boats, without guns, no way to provide for themselves. And this is a proud people who have a long history of providing for themselves. And the government didn't do enough to take care of them. So they started to succumb to tuberculosis and widespread despair.
Was it neglect on the government's part?
Yes. I mean, in the end, everybody had their hands full, and that's it's obvious to say, but that doesn't excuse the treatment that happened to the Aleut people. And so that becomes part of the story as well.
How'd you weave them into the story? The two main characters in this story are a European, you know, white couple.
That's right.
So how'd you weave the natives in, and how did you, you know, get their story told?
It's The Wind Is Not a River is primarily a story of survival that takes place on Attu during the Japanese occupation. One of my main characters, John Easley, is a journalist who actually did sneak into Alaska and was able to get behind enemy lines to watch what's happening. His wife, a Seattle native, is told to stay at home, keep the home fires burning, stay where it's safe, and she doesn't do that. She quickly sets out on a journey to find her husband because she knows no one is going to do that. Along the way, she learns about this story, as he does on the island, of what has happened to the Aleut people. And so their story is woven into the story of survival and love.
Yeah, yeah. Brian Peyton's novel is The Wind Is Not a River. By the way, what is that? What is that phrase from?
That phrase originates from the land itself and the people, the Aleut people. I know it's a bit of a head-scratcher, but it is a phrase that the Aleut people have used with each other for forever, talking about that the duration of suffering doesn't last forever. And they use a reference point of their land. The two biggest reference points are the wind and the ocean. But the river continues to flow. Essentially, the winds, no matter how bad they get, whether it becomes a hurricane force or not in your life, they will at some point stop. And so the suffering will stop. Rivers, however, they run forever. They under plates of ice and their summer sun, the river never ends. Our suffering does have an end. And that's a very important part of the story, and it weaves itself into the narrative of my two main characters.
I see. Yeah, I guess it does. You know, you quote Peter Matheson in an interview that come along with the book that Nancy Pearl did, and yeah. And Matheson as that the landscape, people should emerge from the landscape, that the landscape is critical.
Yeah, Peter Matheson's a writer I admire, and you know, he says these characters shouldn't sort of step off the page, they should step out of the landscape. And when I heard that, I thought that's the kind of writer I want to be. I want my stories to have characters who emerge from the place. And so the environment, therefore, in the story plays a very, very big part, and it becomes a character in its own right.
Yeah, how does John Easley, do you suppose, emerge from the place as a character? What did you see him doing to emerge?
John Easley is a reporter for the National Geographic magazine, and he's sent there on an assignment to write a natural history article about the environment in the Aleutians and the people who live there. So he's writing a very non-war-based story. And when the war breaks out, as a writer, he realizes that, you know, what writer shrinks from this duty? I have a duty to write about this because I'm one of the few journalists in the world who can find the Aleutians on a map, let alone knows what's going on here. So he feels it's his duty to get this story out. And so he's already learning about the landscape. He's learning about the native people and the animals and what it's like to live there. So that's how he emerges into the story.
He has a little experience himself, right? He's sort of a natural. He's a hunter. He's been in the woods.
Well, he's definitely spent time in the wilderness. And more importantly, he spent time observing natural history and going out to record and bring stories back. So he's a very attuned observer to what's going on there.
Brian Peyton is author of The Wind Is Not a River. Did you get to see the battlegrounds?
It was important for me, again, because of my nonfiction training, to go to the Aleutian Islands to get these details right and to walk the landscape and to spend time in the native community. Attu is no longer inhabited. There's a weather station there. It's been automated, so no one lives there, and it's extremely difficult to get to Attu. However, I went out as far as I could in the Aleutian chain, which was Atka, and that's the last island in the chain that is inhabited, and it's inhabited by Aleut people. And so that's where I went to spend my time, out on the landscape, listening to the folks who live there to find out about their experiences and to be out in that environment.
What do the folks tell you about what they remember or took part in the fighting and then what happened to their family members?
These people are very proud people, and they're also proud Americans, and that's an important point to make. They, you know, had no love for the Japanese as they were trying to, you know, clearly harass them and then, of course, take over those two islands. But there's a lot of hurt over the way they were treated during the war and after. Their communities were razed to give the Japanese no quarter as they were expected to make their way down the chain. So they had to rebuild from scratch.
Did you meet any family members or survivors of that time?
I, in fact, most recently have met some survivors of that time, Aleuts, here in Seattle at a book reading I did a couple of weeks ago, and they were in the group and came up, and was very happy to meet them. So yeah. they're here in your community as well.
Did they tell any stories?
We didn't have time to hear their story, but they said that, in fact, their family had been interned and that it was a painful one, a story for them to relive, and that she was going to read my book and hope to you know, find another perspective on that.
How do you feel about that you're doing that work and you once again uncover an ugly chapter in North American history?
Well, you know, it is our history, and it's important to look at it. And I think the reasons behind the evacuation were spot on. I mean, the Aleuts would be probably the first people to tell you that they should have been taken out of harm's way. They dropped the ball, as we like to say here. You know, the Americans did not follow through, and that hurt a lot of people. And so I think it was in the 1990s the federal government did apologize to the Aleut people, and there were some minor reparation made. But it is important to make that recognition that we didn't do what we should have done and that we could have done better.
So I was surprised in reading this book and then doing a little research around it, the amount of infections and deaths from the weather that was encountered. And I don't know, I just was surprised at that.
Unlike so many other places, in this battlefield, the Aleutian Islands were both battlefield and enemy. There were more casualties on the U.S. side because of weather-related incidents than there were people being shot. And so my character, who is not a military man but a journalist, he actually finds himself succumbing to some of these things after a period of time, a long period of time out on the landscape.
How'd you feel about being out on the landscape? Could you see that happening? Was it rough?
It was beautiful and frightening at the same time, because your eye searches for a point of reference. You know, there's not one tree or bush worthy of the term out there. And so you're just searching, where is that anchor point? And, you know, the tallest thing out there is beech rye, just blowing in the wind. And so it's a bit scary, but it's beautiful at the same time.
Brian Peyton's book is The Wind Is Not a River. He'll be at Park Place Books tonight in Kirkland. Thank you, sir.
Thanks for having me.
This is The Record.